So I think quite a lot of what I do is masochistic. I'm interested to do hard things just to see what happens to myself, whether I can make myself keep going. And if I do, how good that feels for just, well, firstly, the pleasure of stopping, but also the self-confidence that comes from knowing you've tested yourself and you've passed the test, and therefore that's likely to help me with other things in life. The motivation for adventure has very much changed from the physical challenges to the mental challenges to these days it's more of a creative curiosity that drives me to do adventures.
Join explorers and travelers on their journeys and discover distant places and fascinating cultures. From the highest peaks and densest jungles into the heart of adventure, this is Unfolding Maps with Eric Lawrence.
My guest today is the English adventurer and author Alistair Humphreys. He has been on expeditions all around the world, traveling through over 80 countries by bicycle, by boat, and on foot. However, when he was named as one of National Geographic's Adventurers of the Year in 2012, this was for a much humbler endeavor, for promoting the philosophy of micro-adventure. In this conversation, we talk about adventures, great and small, and about how they can become part of our lives and enrich them. If you like this conversation, and if you like this show in general, I'd greatly appreciate it if you take the time and leave a rating and review in the Apple Podcast app. Thank you so much for listening, and have fun with our conversation. Hi, Alistair. Welcome to Unfolding Maps. It's great to talk to you.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, today we want to talk a bit about different aspects of adventure, of your adventures, of course, but I'd like to start with a term that at first glance seems to have very little to do with it. I'd like to talk about flabbiness. And according to you, there are three stages of flabbiness in life, right? What stages are those?
Flabbiness, that sort of squidgy belly feeling that we all get at times in our life. The three stages I see it as is, first of all, so flabbiness is, well, it's the fat on your body, but I also see it as just the mental side of just kind of being a bit soft and loose with your life. So I saw it as three things, really. The first being physical, when I'm quite an active guy, I do quite a lot of exercise, but sometimes you just can't really be bothered to go for a run because it's raining. And the next day, you also can't be bothered. And then suddenly, I notice a week's gone by and I'm just getting lazy. So it's that sort of giving up on the physical side. And once I start doing that, I don't do exercise for a while, I then get mentally lazy. And you know, instead of reading a good book or trying to learn something new, I just turn on the telly and suddenly it's midnight and all I've done is watch rubbish programs back to back. And then, of course, you're then tired and lethargic. So the next day you do the same. And if you carry on this for a little while, you end up with a habit of not pushing your body, not pushing your brain. And pretty much then I call it moral flabbiness, which is quite a big claim. But that's just accepting that all of this is good enough for life when really we don't have very long in our lives. And myself, and I imagine many of the people listening to this, so we are in the lucky 1% of people on the planet who can really make the most of our opportunities. And it just seems a terrible waste if we don't. So that hopefully is enough to spur me into action, to make me jump off the sofa and start planning the next adventure.
How or why did you start to think about these stages?
I've always been, as an adult anyway, I've always been very aware that my life is short and that there are so many things that I want to do and places I want to do and so much adventure I want to have. So I've always been very aware of the time, mm-hmm. time passing, and very excited about all the things I still want to do. So I think it's that combination of excitement and impatience and the knowledge that it won't all last forever that gives me the motivation to try and fill the time as full as I can.
And these three stages, they just put this kind of awareness into a specific concept that makes it more tangible for yourself.
Yeah, I guess so. In my own life, I've noticed that I like having done exercise. I don't really think to myself, oh, great, I'd love to go to the gym and suffer on a rowing machine for an hour. I don't really think that way. But I know that once I've been, I come home and I feel happier and healthier for having done that. So it's always a slight laziness in my body and in my brain that I have to try and force myself to overcome. So I quite happily lie on the sofa and eat Chinese takeaway until midnight. But equally, I know that there are probably more things that I should be doing with my life.
And something that you have been doing with your life to escape flabbiness is, of course, living adventurously and experiencing the outdoors in many different ways. And at this point, I would like to quote from an article that you wrote some time ago for Outward Bound. And you wrote in there, "Walking a long way over a big hill teaches you at least as much about yourself and life as a dollop of classroom education does. Every night spent running over the moors, every freezing river swim, every long-distance bike ride, this is classic old-fashioned character building," unquote. When have you, for the first time, realized the strength of the impact of the outdoors on you and on building your character?
I was very lucky in that I was introduced to the outdoors at quite an early age through my school, probably 10, 11, 12, 13, that sort of age. We started doing things that involved being in the hills or rivers or small little sailing boats. And I enjoyed those things, but I also really enjoyed that it was out of school, because school, I used to get really frustrated that I wasn't in the football team or I wasn't the fastest kid or the coolest kid, all those sort of things. Whereas when you're out in the outdoors, in the mountains don't care about that. And the mountains are bigger and tougher than all of us. So all you can ever do, whoever you are, is just try your best. So it felt like a meritocracy. It felt an equal place where everyone could just push themselves as much as they chose to do. And I enjoyed that equality and freedom that came from spending time in the hills as a young person.
And did you explore and discover this meaning of the hills and nature in general? Did you explore that and discover that gradually? Or was there any specific event, any occasion that made that really clear for you what it means to be outside?
No, it was a gradual thing. I think when I was a kid, my brain didn't think about anything very much except that it's quite fun to be outside doing adventures. And then when I was in my early 20s, so when I went to university, I joined, in Britain we have a weekend army. It's part of the army, but it's just reserves, so you can do it in your spare time, really. So I joined that. I had no interest in the army. I didn't really like the guns, and I found all that quite boring, but I really loved that you got paid to go and run around the hills. And the beer was very cheap. So during that time, I started to realize that this was a world that I could be quite good at. You know, I was quite willing to persevere and be stubborn and to endure and to suffer, and that actually having a hard time in the mountains was a way to, when you came home and you went to the pub with your friends for a beer, you really, really enjoyed it and really appreciated it, having done that hard work out in the mountains. So it was those years when I spent running around the rainy hills of Scotland that it started to feel like an important thing in my life rather than just a fun thing, and to become a thing that I wanted to really concentrate more of my time and effort. And at the time, I didn't consider it as, oh, I'd like to make my job out of this. I just thought I would like, this feels important to me. How can I get as much of it in my life as I can?
And something that I think also feels important to you up to this day is the memory to or of your time in South Africa, because that's where you went after finishing high school, right? You went there to live and to teach in a little village there.
So before the university army that I just described, I spent a year teaching in a small little school. And what I particularly enjoyed about that was my first time to Africa. It was my first time out of Europe. And I remember just how big and blue the sky was and how empty and red the landscape was as we drove for hours from the airport and Johannesburg up towards this little village where I was going to spend a year. And I just remember being so, well, quite scared that I was out of my comfort zone of home, but also just realizing that the world was far, far bigger and more colorful and more exciting than I'd realized at that time. So I think your first adventure is always the one that shapes you the most. But it was that time in rural South Africa got me really excited about wanting to see more places in the world.
And this is something, some desire that you really followed. It was a passion that was sparked probably in this instance. Would you say that your time in South Africa was the main inspiration, the main driver for this massive adventure that followed?
It was a combination of a year in South Africa made me want to go and see the world, like a lot of young people want to go and see the world. So that was my awakening of, wow, I want to go see more places. And then followed up with my time spent running around the mountains of Scotland that made me want to keep up this physical outdoor challenge side of things. So that then made me think, how can I go and see the world, but do it in a way that is physically difficult and challenging? And that led me to the idea of trying to go on a long journey by bicycle, which I still think after all these years is the best way to go and have an adventure.
And it was not only a long journey, but a very long journey. It led you around the world over 4 years, I believe, through 60 yep. countries and 74,000 kilometers.
Yes. Yep. It was a long, long bike ride. I cycled from England through Europe and the Middle East down to South Africa, and then from Patagonia to Alaska, and then from northeastern Siberia back across Asia and Europe and eventually back home to the UK.
This idea of cycling around the world was a challenge that you yourself thought would be almost impossible to succeed, and you were pretty sure you would fail. Why did you pick such a challenging challenge, for lack of a better word?
I wanted to see how far I could go, both literally and I suppose mentally. And you know, I could have said to myself, oh, maybe, why don't I try and cycle from London to Berlin? And that would still have been the biggest bike ride of my life. But I probably would have got to Berlin. And then I'd get to Berlin and I'd have thought, well, I could have done a bit more. So I deliberately chose a target that just felt stupidly huge, because although you might fail at the end of, you might fail to reach the goal, along the way, you will do more and go further than if you'd set yourself the destination before beginning. So I didn't really think I'd cycle around the world. And what I really meant, I suppose, was I'm just going to go for a really long bike ride and see how far I get. But that sounds like a slightly vague thing to say. So it's simpler just to say, I'm going to go and try to cycle around the world.
And you surprised yourself, I guess, because you indeed mastered the challenge and the trip turned indeed into a global journey. And of course, it's very hard. First of all, it's a few years ago now. And second of all, it's always very annoying, I believe, to get questions like, what was your highlight? What did you learn from it? Because it's, I mean, already 1 month of this intensity of experience. It's hard to summarize in a few sentences. But luckily for me, you wrote a book about this trip, and it's called 10 Lessons from the Road. And in this book, I believe you really tried to pin down what you have learned and which lessons you have taken away from this massive trip. Is there any lessons, or any two or three lessons, that are especially important to you today that you have been able to take away from this trip?
Yeah, I think it's doing a big, big journey is interesting, because you can take lessons in lots of ways. So, you know, if I think of that journey, of course, there's the beautiful places I went, there's the exciting adventures, there's the interesting people I met, and then there's the lessons that perhaps are a bit more broad and a bit more applicable to everyone in daily life. And I think that side of thing is what has increasingly interested me about adventure. I think if I had to choose two lessons then from cycling around the world, the first would have been the amazing benefit that had for my self-confidence to start something which I didn't think I'd be able to do, and then surprise myself by actually cycling all the way around the world. has then been really helpful for me in my self-confidence for trying other things. So, for example, I'd never written a book before. I thought, maybe I can try. And it's just given me this confidence to try things a lot more. So that side of adventure helping self-confidence has been a good thing. And then something which I think is relevant to all of us at all times was just how safe and friendly and kind and welcoming the world was. And I've come back with a very different impression of the world to what you see on the TV news, that the world generally is a good place full of good, kind people. And I think that's a useful thing to hold in our minds at all times, especially when you turn on the TV news and it sometimes seems that everywhere's going a bit crazy and disastrous.
That's very nice to hear. It's something that in a very similar way, Charlie Borman also described this impression and this takeaway from his travels just a few weeks ago when I talked to him. Do you ever have difficulties? Do you ever find it difficult to hold onto this knowledge now that you are not able to travel quite as much and quite as intensely and are still being confronted with media news coverage every day?
Something I find really helpful is that, because I've been to about 90 countries, I think now, is that quite often when the news comes on and something bad's happening in some far off corner of the world, it strikes me as a closer memory. It's often a place that I've been to and I remember towns, I remember places, and I remember people from it. And it helps humanize the world a lot more. So, for example, I cycle through Syria before the civil war, which has now been running for 7-8 years. And I think all of us really, even with the best will in the world, we get kind of bored of those stories and we sort of ignore it and think, oh yeah, war in Syria, 7 years. And we sort of forget, our brains filter these things out. And I think having been through places and remembered it helps me keep things, to remind myself that places are more real than that. But by and large, the positive memories I've had from different countries has stayed with me forever. So for example, I spend a lot of time in London, and most people you meet in London are from other countries, it seems. You get in a taxi in London and you have a conversation immediately about Pakistan or Zimbabwe or Bolivia. And I love that connection that I have of being able to say to people in my own town, I've been to your place. And I really, really like that aspect of having traveled widely. I think it's certainly the best education, and it's certainly the best way to remove problems like the hatred that seems to spread from people who haven't traveled very much.
How do you explain that in our globalized and connected world, as connected as never before, this isn't the clear tendency? Because one could suspect that due to the connectiveness and due to people traveling more and more, the result should be what you are just saying, that we understand more easily, that we have so much more in common than we sometimes tend to think.
You're right that we are more connected than ever, but there are still, I think it's still a bit of a confirmation bias of people like you and I tend to talk to people like you and I. And I enjoyed, for example, cycling through America, where huge numbers of people there don't even have a passport, because America is such a big and varied country that in many ways you don't need one. So I think although there's an increase in people who are traveling, there's still vast numbers of people who do not. And I think from that is where the voice of disaffection usually comes from, I think.
One lesson in your book was titled Thinking Like a Goldfish. What did you mean with that?
Well, goldfish are famous for having a very short memory. I've no idea if that's true or not, but the wisdom is that a goldfish has a 3-second memory. And I think that's quite a useful skill to have on a difficult expedition, is to just, as much as you can, just deal with the moment you are in right now. Don't think that you still have a week or a month of freezing cold to go. Just deal with this moment right now. And don't think to yourself, I've been doing this for so long, I'm bored. Just deal with this right now. And I sometimes think that when I don't have a dog myself, but if I go into the mountains with someone who's brought their dog with them, I love the fact that the dog wakes up in the morning, it eats its breakfast, and then it walks out of the front door with no clothes, no equipment, no idea where it's going, and it just runs and it's happy for the entire day until it's so tired, and then it lies down and goes to sleep. And I think having that sort of attitude is the best way to really embrace a good adventure. So I'm always quite jealous of dogs. You can't take a goldfish up a mountain, so it doesn't really apply for that. But somewhere between a goldfish and a dog, I think, is the ideal adventure mindset.
Plus maybe some clauses here and there, but the mindset.
Dogs are also a reminder as just to how pathetic us humans are. You know, if we're going to hills, we eat sort of special energy gels, and we spend hundreds of pounds on a raincoat, and we do all sorts of complicated stuff. Whereas a dog just eats a bowl of biscuits and off it goes. So, yeah, I like a dog.
How did it feel after these 4 years to finally end the trip and come back to Britain?
It felt like a huge relief that I didn't have to ride my bike tomorrow, and that I would not be a stranger in a town, and that I'd know my way to the shops, and that I'd be able to understand the conversations, and I'd belong to a culture. I wasn't just the exotic, strange specimen going through the town. So it was a huge relief. It was also very sad that I knew then that the biggest adventure of my life was over, and I was only 29, so that felt quite sad. And then real life, I'd been looking forward to getting back to real life for so long, and then of course you get back to real life and it's quite boring a lot of the time. So I then felt quite restless and rootless, and I often say that I don't think going on a big adventure is the way to have a happy life. It's the way to have an interesting life, perhaps, but it leads you to being quite restless and rootless from then on, I think. So in all the years since that journey, I've had a mixture of when I'm at home, I want to be off on an adventure. And when I'm off on an adventure, I finally remember the importance of home and community, and I want to be back home again. So I think it's led to restlessness, really.
Did you come back from this trip with a kind of plan of what you wanted to do afterwards? Because you just said you had like 4 years to think about coming back and looking forward to quote unquote normal life.
Yeah, I was excited to come home and to see friends again and to just enjoy the good parts of normal routine life. So I was excited by a lot of those sort of things, sleeping in a bed and talking to friends and all that sort of stuff. So I was really, really looking forward to that side of things. And my vague hope really was that I wanted to write a book. I wanted to write a book just because I loved reading books. I was curious about whether I could write one, and I kind of wanted to get that story down. But then I assumed that after that, whenever that came about, then it would be time to return to real life and return to my original plans in life, which had to become a teacher, a high school teacher. So I assumed that now I'd got the adventure out of my system, it was time to grow up and get a proper job and become a teacher.
That was your original plan. When did you start to feel or to know that actually you wanted to do something else? You wanted to, in some way or the other, continue to have adventures and being an adventurer?
Well, I did become a teacher. I became a teacher and I enjoyed being a teacher, and I was a good teacher and I was enjoying it. But in that first year of teaching, I kept thinking, man, there's still a lot of adventures I haven't done. There's a lot of cool places still to go. I could go and do a few more years of adventure and come back and be a teacher when I'm 35 or 40 or 50, and those years of adventure won't make me a worse teacher. In fact, I suspect they'll make me a better teacher. So I just felt there was unfinished business with the world of adventure, and I should go do some more of that before I became a teacher. So I, after 1 year in the school, I quit the job, and that was 13 years ago. So I've 12 years ago. So I've managed 12 years now without a proper job.
Congratulations. Yeah. Yes, it's going pretty well, I believe.
Yes. Yeah. And I think actually now, having worked for myself for all this time, I think I'd really struggle to have a structured, ordered job with all the systems that somewhere like an office environment would have. I think I'd struggle with that these days.
Another of your many challenges that followed was to walk through southern India. Would you talk about that a bit? Where did you start your journey, and where did you go from there?
when I cycled around the world, I didn't go to India. And that felt to me like a real missed place. After 4 years on a bike, I didn't want to do a bicycle. I was kind of sick of bikes. So I wanted to do something even slower and even simpler. And therefore, the idea of going for a walk came to my mind. I had about 7 weeks spare. So I just worked out roughly how far I could walk in that time. And then I looked down the triangle shape of India till I reached the distance that I thought I could cover the time I had. And I ended up walking from just south of Chennai through Tamil Nadu, Karnataka, and finished on the coast in Kerala. And then I jumped on a night train, zoomed all the way across India back the way I'd come, and flew back home. It was an incredibly simple, cheap, slow, fascinating journey with all of the joys, delights, frustrations, irritations, and ups and downs of a trip to India that anyone who's ever been there will be familiar with. But with the added, when you're walking, you're really, really immersed in a country. And India is quite an exhausting country to be immersed in. There are a billion people who at every hour of day and night want to talk to you and invite you to their homes for a cup of tea and a conversation about cricket.
Do you remember any particular moments or memories or meetings, encounters that were only made possible because you have been walking?
Well, I deliberately chose a route that was just more or less at random, but I wanted it to be not going to any so-called tourist places. I didn't want to go to the Taj Mahal. I didn't want to go to the popular beaches in Goa. I just wanted to go to places that were normal India, if such a thing could possibly exist. So imagine some industrial normal town in the country that you live in. I wanted to walk through places like that. So I was really looking for the ordinary, and I was interested how the India version of ordinary would be so different to the English version of ordinary. That's what I was looking for on the trip, really. And I think the thing that walking gave to me from that was just the spontaneity and the surprise. So each day you have no idea what will be round the next corner in the next village and who then will invite you to your house. And so if you travel by bus or train, you tend to go from destination to destination. But the good thing about going on a foot and also by bicycle is that you have access to the places in between. And this means that villagers on small little roads can see you and invite you to their house, having never really had a conversation with some European before. And I think the freshness and the novelty and the surprise of that is a real delight that you can get best of all by walking trips or bicycling trips.
I've read in an interview that you claim you love walking long distances besides other things because it's extremely painful. Could you elaborate on that?
Walking really is very painful. It's much, much harder than cycling and really slow. And your rucksack on your back really hurts. And if you get stuck with some really annoying person, it's harder to escape from them as you can on a bicycle.
That's
so
true.
So being on foot is hard, really hard. And if you're somewhere that's quite boring, you'll probably be in that boring place for a whole day. Whereas on a bicycle, you can just pedal quicker and get off to somewhere else. So it is hard. The reason I like that is for the feeling of how good it is after you stop. So I think quite a lot of what I do is masochistic. I'm interested to do hard things just to see what happens to myself, whether I can make myself keep going. And if I do, how good that feels for just, well, firstly, the pleasure of stopping, but also the self-confidence that comes from knowing you've tested yourself and you've passed the test, and therefore that's likely to help me with other things in life that are perhaps a bit different to the pain of walking across a hot plain in India.
So the physical hardship is in general really an important factor for you in terms of adventures?
It certainly used to be for many years. So in the first years, that was the most important thing. And I think I enjoyed the physical hardship because I felt I was good at, I was able to keep going. And therefore, for the first time in my life, I felt that I was good at something. It helped me stand out from being average. So I enjoyed that. And increasingly over time, I suppose it's a combination of having done it quite a lot of times and also just getting old that I'm much less interested in that these days. So My most recent walk I did was through Spain. I walked 800 kilometers through Spain playing my violin. And what I really noticed, and I was 39 then. So what I really noticed then on that trip was if I was tired and I was in a lot of pain, then I would just stop and have a sit down and maybe a sleep under a tree. And I kept thinking to myself, oh, this is so much nicer than the pain I used to put myself through. So maybe I'm getting sensible at last, or perhaps I'm just getting soft. But certainly the motivation for adventure has very much changed from the physical challenges to the mental challenges to these days. It's more of a creative curiosity that drives me to do adventures.
Adventures such as the walk across Spain that you have just mentioned and that you have turned into a book now, your very current book. It's called My Midsummer Morning, which is in turn inspired by another book. Would you talk a bit about that inspiration behind the project?
The inspiration to that project is a book called As I Walked Out One Midsummer Morning by an English guy called Laurie Lee. And he is not a very famous book in England, but in the 1930s, he walked through Spain playing his violin. And it's a simple, beautiful, slow journey. And ever since I've read it, I've always loved that book and I've always wanted to do it myself. But I can't play the violin at all. So I kept putting it off for about 15 years. I kept thinking, oh, I'd like to do this, but I can't do music, therefore I can't. But linking to my last answer about the creative side of adventure, I've just done quite a lot of physical adventures and they excite me less than they used to. And I realized that if I wanted to try to get this feeling of the risk of failing, the fear of failing, unknowing, the doubt, the vulnerability, all these things that I used to get from big adventures, if I wanted to get those in adventure these days, I needed to do something a bit different. And that gave me the idea of trying to learn the violin for a few months and then walking from northwestern Spain to Madrid over a month with no money, no credit card, and only my violin skills to earn money by playing the violin in towns across Spain.
Your violin skills, which were probably still rather humble, I would suspect.
Yeah, they are absolutely terrible. Now, the problem with saying I'm bad at the violin is most people just think you are being modest. But actually, if you Google me and my violin, I'm really bad. I sound like a six-year-old kid. I could play five very short songs very badly. So I was terrible. And I'd never performed in public at all until the first morning in Spain when I stood there with no money in my pocket thinking, if I want to eat today, I have to play the violin and I have to try and earn a coin. And that was a fascinating experience in fear because I was so scared doing this. I felt the same level of scared, the same fear that I felt when I set off to row the Atlantic Ocean in a small little rowing boat. And I found that very interesting, the different aspects of fear. Fear of a physical adventure like being in an ocean and the more internal human society fears of looking like an idiot, basically.
Yeah, that's really interesting because it seems like this fear and this fear of being and becoming an amateur again in a discipline is really the essence of this adventure in Spain, right?
Yes, it was being willing to be bad at something, be willing to step out of my comfort zone. I think pretty much all of us in life, When we talk to young kids, we always try and encourage kids to, oh, go try this thing. You've never done it before. Give it a go. Go try this sport. Go and try learning the violin. We say these things to children, but then as adults, we tend to just think, oh, I'm not a musical person, or I'm good at these sort of things. And we just stay doing those sort of things. So I was really interested in pushing my boundaries to try something that I don't feel is part of my character, and therefore to stretch myself and challenge myself in a very similar attitude to how I was trying to stretch myself and challenge myself by originally cycling a long ways. But this was a more internal, mental and creative challenge, I guess.
You write in the book, I have not been that incompetent for decades. So
yeah. I mean, usually as an adult, we find what we're good at and we just do that, yes, a lot, and we stay away from the stuff we're bad at because it's embarrassing. And I loved this feeling of just being really bad at something once I overcome my embarrassment and just embracing it, just of saying to the world, or in this case, screeching on the violin to the world, I'm really bad at this, but I'm trying my best. And I really enjoyed that once I got over the fear.
And I mean, we also have to mention that playing a violin badly is a little bit more brutal than playing some of the other instruments badly, right? I mean, if you play the guitar badly, that's, you know, a pity, but it doesn't really hurt. But a violin can be a different matter.
Oh, it sounds so terrible. I do not know. I mean, in England, it's the instrument that they always try and teach to little kids, but I do not know why. It is so hard and sounds so terrible. I quite often actually listen on the radio, on my music to really good violin playing, and it's so beautiful, but it's just, I mean, that's decades of work away from what I could do. So my music just sounded terrible, which of course just makes people laugh at me, really, because it sounds so bad to play that in a plaza in a small village in Spain. And I don't look at all Spanish, so I was obviously some foreign guy, and I wasn't in a tourist area. So I was just a foreign guy in a random little Spanish village, ruining the peace and quiet of the day by playing very badly. It was a very, I think people must have thought I was very strange.
Yeah, so how did they react? Which kind of responses did you get by the people who had the pleasure of hearing you play?
Well, my fear before was that people would be unkind and they tell me to go away, and I think a lot of my fear was of how people would treat me. But as always, I think we all think of ourselves as being very important, whereas most people don't care about us because most people are just busy doing their own day. So most people just ignored me. Some people looked at me like I was strange or wrinkled up their nose in a sort of, oh, this sounds terrible.
How did that make you feel? Did that directly put you into deep despair, or were you like confident enough, despite the lack of skill, that this the negative reactions didn't affect you so much?
Well, they weren't really unkind reactions. They were just reactions of, whoa, you're bad, which I just found very funny, because I had to agree with them.
Yes.
I was very bad. So I found those reactions funny. And actually nobody was unkind. No one came up to me and said, shut up, or you're stupid, or anything like that. The worst that happened is people ignore you, and I could handle that. And quite a few people would laugh and they'd catch my eye and they'd find it funny. And it became a really nice communal shared experience, even though it was surrounded by strangers, most of whom would only pass by for 2 or 3 seconds and then they're gone. It felt like a shared feeling, and I really enjoyed that. It very much depended on me trusting in the kindness of people, because I needed to earn some money if I was to eat, and I didn't have a sign up explaining what I was doing, or I wasn't asking people, please give me money. I was just standing there and playing, as you see musicians do in the street. And I was trusting in the kindness that someone would reward me for my effort, although they would not be rewarding me for my skill, but perhaps they would see that I was trying, I was putting out my best effort, and therefore they might reward that. That's what I was hoping for.
Could you guess after a while who would give you money and who wouldn't?
Yes, definitely. There definitely are trends of people. The best people to give me money were older people, so people over, say, 50 or 60, that sort of age. I think people under, say, 30 were usually just focused on their smartphones and would not notice me. People up to maybe 40 were busy. They had places to go, they were working, and they were busy, so they were just in a hurry. And then older people, I think, have a bit more time. They also are more likely to have coins in their pocket than younger people who just have plastic or phones. So my best customers were men who are aged about 50 or 60. That was the best. They were the best customers, I think.
Interesting. What did it make you feel like when you earned your very first coin?
Oh, that was one. The first coin I earned was one of the most exciting, thrilling moments in all of my life of adventure. I really felt I was pretty close to quitting because I was doing so badly, and no one had given me any money, and I felt such an idiot. So the first coin just gave me relief and hope. And of course, once you've earned one coin, you know you can earn a second coin. So it made the whole trip, boom, instantly feel like, ah, this actually is possible. If you've earned one coin, you can earn a second coin. So Yeah, that was such a thrill. I remember exactly, it was an elderly gentleman who gave me the coin. And from that moment, I just instantly knew that the trip was possible.
If you would have known the impact of this little moment of kindness.
Yeah, I wish I told him that it was the first coin I'd ever earned from playing the violin. He was on his way to church, actually, so I didn't have time to explain to him exactly what I was doing. But I would love if I could find him and go and give him a copy of my book or something to say, look, I've done it and thank you very much. But that's often the way with kindness. You do a tiny bit of kindness. You don't really know what impact it might have. And that whole journey was just his kindness passing me on to the next person's kindness. This chain of kind people got me all the way to Madrid.
So that also means that evidently you have been able to make enough money to eat and to survive your journey through Spain.
I actually earned a fortune. I earned so much more than I thought I would. And by a fortune, I mean that I earned 120 euros in a month, which is far more money than any man needs to live. I could buy bread and bananas and tomatoes and even a tiny cup of coffee every so often to sit in a cafe and charge up all my camera batteries at the same time. I never ever thought I would earn as much money as that.
And did the trip achieve what you set out to do, to reduce your fear or to increase your personal courage, your confidence?
Yeah, definitely. It showed me that adventure means much more than just riding a bike or climbing a mountain. It felt that this feeling of the adventure that I got from playing the violin has opened my world to a much wider place of what living adventurously might mean. So I feel very grateful for that. It was, again, a boost for my confidence, and I would feel happy now to try and make it across a country by, I don't know, drawing pictures or dancing or something else that I'm really, really bad at. So it's definitely changed my mindset a lot. It was one of my favorite adventures of my life, and the adventure really was just playing the violin, which many people would not think of it being an adventurous thing to do.
But the process of seeing adventures in a new light has started quite a while before that for you already. I mean, we have mentioned some of your adventures, India and the cycling tour around the world, but you've had so many more adventures. You rode across the Atlantic Ocean. I think you mentioned it in passing. You ran 6 marathons through the Sahara Desert. You completed a crossing of Iceland and trekked 1,000 miles across the empty Quarter Desert and many, many more. But I think at some point you realized that you don't have to go all the way to India or around the world for an adventure, but that it is more of an attitude, a question of attitude. And this was not in Spain, but quite a while before that. How did this realization start for you?
There are a few different things happened, one of which was that I started to be aware that by now I'd written a few books and writing blogs, so there was an audience of people interested in adventure. And I realized that the number of people who were interested in adventure was much, much bigger than the number of people who were actually out crossing deserts. They're pretty quiet places. So why were these people liking adventure but not doing it? So that was one question I asked. And then the other thing I noticed was that whether I was freezing cold in Greenland or boiling hot in the desert, these very different adventures, I was getting the same benefits and I was doing them for the same reasons, and that most of this stuff was inside in my head. And therefore, perhaps it didn't matter where I went to do an adventure. It was more about the attitude I went with. And so perhaps I didn't need to go to the ends of the world to have an adventure. Perhaps I could have an adventure much closer to home. And a close to home adventure might help all these people who enjoyed adventure but weren't doing it because of real life. That might help them have adventures too.
And this kind of normal life, I think it also became reality for yourself, because you also got married and had kids and had to figure out how to fit your adventures into a quote unquote normal life.
Exactly. So that was the catalyst that prompted me into the change was I suddenly didn't have the same amount of spare time and freedom that I had. Real life arrived for me as well. So how can you have adventure without spending much time, spending much money, close to home, local. So I started trying to do the sorts of adventures that I loved, but just short, local, and simple, and as close to home as possible. And I call these micro-adventures, so deliberately small, short bursts of adventure, because ultimately you have a choice. If you don't have enough time to go climb Mount Everest, you can just sit on your sofa and get flabby, or you can think, what can I do? How much time do I have? What is still possible? Even if that's just one night away on your local hill, that's still a small bit of adventure, which is better than no adventure at all.
How can a night on a hill capture the essence of what an adventure is or can be, ideally?
So walking up a hill, watching the sunset, sleeping under the stars, gives you some physical exercise. It gives you some mental headspace. You turn off your phone. It takes you into the countryside. You see the stars. You feel the wind. You're out in nature. And all of these things are the things that you do big adventures for. So it's small, but it's still giving you a little bit of all of these things that you get from adventures. And I often find actually that in a busy life, just one night away on a hill is a really good way of resetting your brain, refreshing yourself, taking a different look at life and a different look at the place that you live, and perhaps opening up your eyes to realize that there are more opportunities for adventure and escape and wilderness close to where you live than you might have realized. And perhaps it starts to get you thinking that you don't need to be saving up for a once-in-a-lifetime journey to Alaska, but instead you can have a lifetime of small adventures just around your hometown with your friends and your family, and therefore perhaps combine both real life, which is necessity for most of us and a good thing for most of us, but combine that also with this carefree, exciting, adventurous life. And if you can mix a bit of real life and a bit of adventure, I think that's a pretty good combination.
Walking in a forest or up a hill, as you have mentioned, or walking or jumping into a lake, these are things not everyone would necessarily equate with an adventure, not even with a small adventure, but simply with being outside and doing stuff. Why did you feel that it might be helpful to coin a phrase like micro-adventure, which, by the way, is a term that I believe you came up with?
Yes, I did come up with that phrase, and I chose it because I wanted to say not just a small adventure, little adventure, really, 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 really small, micro. If it feels like an adventure to you in some way, then it is an adventure. And yes, jumping in a river or walking up a hill for some people isn't an adventure. That's just going outside. But for other people, people who have never swum in a river or climbed a hill, then it is an adventure. So I wanted to remove that feeling of comparison, like my adventure is better than your adventure, or my adventure doesn't count because you have done something bigger. I wanted to try and remove that and say that if it feels like an adventure to you, then it is an adventure. But I'm also very keen to say that I haven't invented anything. All I'm saying to people is, hey, go for a bike ride, go camping, go hiking, go swimming, stuff that many people have done for many years. But by packaging it in one word, my hopes with that was to make people think that, yeah, this can feel like an adventure, and I should therefore get out and go do it. So yeah, I haven't invented anything, but I find having the word has actually been quite useful for building a community of people who are doing this sort of stuff. And once you see other people like you doing these things, then it gives you the confidence to try it as well. So when I first started trying to build the idea of micro-adventures, I worked very hard to get a load of regional Facebook groups of people, which are nothing to do with me except that I encouraged people to start them, just so that people in that area could go do a micro-adventure, share their photographs, and hopefully encourage other people to do the same. Because what I didn't want is for people to look at me and think, oh, there's a healthy, white, male, middle-class guy doing adventures. It's fine for him, but I can't do it because I am X, Y, and Z in life. And the more that you see different people doing these things, the more you start to feel it's applicable to you. And I think that's another reason why having a name for this thing, micro-adventure has been a helpful thing for growing a community of people.
Yeah, to really show that you can do it and to increase awareness and have a call to action. So in this sense, I believe it's not only a nice phrase for people who never jumped into a river or slept in the forest, but also to people who might have done that many years ago, but have more or less forgotten about these little nice outdoor experiences that we can have in everyday life. And I don't know if I believe you also know Christo Förster, right? He's the guy who took your concept to Germany and in part also, of course, added his own ideas and suggestions. And I had an interview with him for the German version of this podcast. And he told me a funny anecdote because, of course, he is confronted with a kind of similar skepticism or criticism sometimes in terms of what this term tries to express. And he talked about talking to a previous army guy, like an old guy, an old German guy. And he said, well, this is kind of ridiculous. Why do we need a phrase like that? I have already been sleeping outside in the army like 30, 40 years ago. That's nothing new. That's nothing special. And then Christo asked, okay, so when did you sleep outside for the last time? Well, as I said, 30, 40 years ago. So yeah, that's the point, right? You can do it anytime, and you should, because it's beneficial.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And I think, again, I mentioned this in a different context earlier, but we're always trying to encourage children to get outside and get some exercise and do this sort of thing. All the things that are important for the health, physical health and mental health of children. But they're much more important for us adults. Kids have got an easy life. It's us adults who are stressed and overweight and all these problems we have. And I think a lot of those are helped by going on a small little micro-adventure and climbing a hill.
So let's say you have convinced me. I almost feel ready now to do my first micro-adventure. I want to be outside more often, but I don't know how to start. What's the next step, the first thing I could do and that you would recommend?
I think the thing to do is to think of whatever big adventure sounds exciting to you, and then try and work out a small version. And if you're still feeling this resistance, work out what it is that's stopping you. What is it you're scared of, or what practical problem? And then find an even smaller option that gets around that fear or that problem you have. And keep going until you've come up with an idea that is so small that you no longer have any excuses not to go and do it. And start with that tiny, tiny, tiny thing, which might be an hour, or it might be an hour in your local woods. Hopefully you'll do that and think, oh, that was great. And then you have some confidence and some momentum and some enthusiasm and some experience, all of which will mean that next week you're ready to go for 2 hours or for an afternoon, and gradually build up like that. So I think that first tiny little step, thinking like a goldfish, is a really important thing for microadventures, making the smallest version of it that you can, and then building up from there.
You are now living off your adventures, of the stories you tell about them. Do you still sometimes have to justify these quieter adventures because of the persistence of your public persona as that adventure guy, even now, even after all these micro-adventure years?
When I first started doing micro-adventures, I really worried that my career would stop, because at that point I just started to earn enough money out of doing big adventures, and I was trying to be this big tough adventure guy, and so I really worried that no one would care about going to sleep on a hill for the night, and that actually that would ruin my credibility.
Yeah, you once called it the biggest risk you have taken in your life outside of your big adventures.
It felt like a risk for my career, and it definitely felt like a risk for my self-respect and my self-esteem. And for quite a while, micro-adventures, it felt like a really good idea, but also I still wanted to be this big tough guy, so I didn't altogether like it that much myself. So for a few years after starting micro-adventures, I kept trying to stop it and then get on and doing other stuff, but the idea wouldn't go away. Every interview, people would ask me about it. It's what most people emailed me about. The book I wrote about it sold much more than my book about walking across India. And so I've now accepted that I am now Mr. Microadventure, and that my role in life is to get people to go and sleep on a hill. And that actually, that is a much more useful thing to do with the ego of crossing an ocean or something like that. So I'm now quite happy with being Mr. Micro Adventure Man. That I'm fine with that these days.
What does living adventurously mean to you today?
Living adventurously to me today is very different to 20 years ago. And it took me a long time to allow myself to change the definition as time passed. But these days for me, what excites me now is being in natural places. So being in the outdoors, being in beautiful places, and they can be 1 mile from my house. I don't care about that anymore. And it's creative. It's doing things that are new and make me think and excite my imagination, my curiosity. So that's really the direction that I'm heading into these days. I think my days of walking a long way just because it hurts might finally be over.
Very nice. I think that is a nice way to conclude the interview, except for I would like to do a little lightning round, if you are fine with that. Just a few short questions. I mean, if you want to answer them sure. in a longer fashion, that's of course also fine. But the questions will be just a little bit more random and quick.
Okay.
I was happiest while traveling in...
In Spain. Spain was the first adventure I've ever done where I actually thought to myself, I'm really, really happy on this adventure. Most of my adventures have been about misery, but I was actually really happy there.
What made you so happy? Was it really just the knowledge and the experience of people being kind, or was there something else?
It was lots of things. It was that this crazy idea of playing the violin was actually going to work. It was that I dreamt of this journey for years, but I'd always been too scared to do it. And now I was actually doing it. And it was also, as I briefly mentioned it just then, it was that I was allowing my definitions of adventure to change. I was realizing that the rules I made for my life when I was 22 about pushing myself and being so tough, they didn't have to apply now that I was 39. And it was okay to give myself permission to live life differently. So it was quite a feeling of relief as well, I think.
One of the probably most dangerous situations I got myself into while traveling?
I try and avoid dangerous situations, really, but I did nearly die paddling down a river in Iceland and in a small little rubber boat. And I think what's interesting about that was that my decision to... So I looked at this river and it was... I wasn't sure if I was good enough to paddle it. But what made me do the decision in the end was I thought to myself, this will look so good on YouTube. So I went to paddle the river, mostly out of the arrogance of being able to show off on the internet. And I nearly died. I didn't quite die. I got out of the river and then I realized that I hadn't turned on my camera. So there were lots of different life lessons okay. in that. But the main one being that I now, before I do anything, adventure, write a book, whatever, I ask myself, would I do this if nobody ever found out? And that helps me do things for the right reason.
A common misconception about being an adventurer is?
A common misconception about being an adventurer is that you are always out on your adventures. Whereas the reality is, like most jobs, you are mostly at a computer.
Yes.
That's certainly the case for me anyway.
What's the biggest chunk of computer time that you have to spend?
Well, it takes a lot of work to make it seem to the world as though you never do any work and that you are always just out on adventures. So I spend a lot of time just at my desk working, just like normal people, I guess.
My advice to a young person starting out is to...
Ooh, my advice to a young person starting out on adventure is to go and do an adventure because you really, really want to do it. And ask yourself the question, would I do this if nobody ever found out? And try, I'm going to sound really old now, try and turn off your phone as much as possible and take a notebook with you and write down what you're seeing and thinking, because you'll enjoy that book when you're old and looking back on things.
If I were only allowed to take one more trip.
Ooh, if I was only allowed to take one more trip, I would go to Antarctica. It's the only continent I have never been to, and I would love to go there. I suspect I'll never get there, so I will choose that.
I consider my greatest success so far.
Oh, my greatest success. Well, I suppose I'll keep it relevant to our conversation. I think my greatest success is to making a life and a career out of doing what I really love, and therefore loving 9 o'clock on a Monday morning.
Are you able to pinpoint what were some of the most essential decisions or levers that you applied in order to make that possible?
Well, first of all, go do interesting stuff. So you have to go do interesting adventures. You have to work hard at telling your stories in a way that is interesting and useful, not just as a way to make yourself look really cool and tough. And then treating this fun adventure stuff like a job, sitting down every single day and working really, really hard at whatever you're doing and repeating that for 10 years before it finally starts to work. So yeah, combination of doing good stuff and then persistently working hard at it, I think.
And you also mentioned the stuff that you are doing should be relevant for people you are telling these stories. What would you say, what makes these stories relevant?
I mean, it doesn't have to be. You can do stuff that's totally irrelevant to people and it's just escapism and fascinating. Like, for example, the climber, Alex Honnold. No one is ever going to do the stupid stuff he does, but it's fascinating to watch. So that's one option to do it. My approach has been to try to take the things that I have done and the lessons that I've done that have been useful in my own life and try and package those in a way that might be applicable and relevant and interesting to other people. So whether that's the practical thing of here's a bunch of micro adventure ideas or the more metaphors that have come from the adventures and the lessons, which I guess has been the basis of doing the talks I do and some of the writing as well.
I find it difficult to...
I find it difficult to relax. I find it difficult to stop working and I find it difficult to just be satisfied with what I have right now.
Are you able to relax in any specific moments? Are there any specific moments that tend to make it easy for you to relax?
Well, I think I've just made it hard for myself because the things that relax me are, I don't know, cycling, running, being in the hills, all these sort of things. That's what I love and I relax, I suppose, because I love them. But equally, they're also now my job. So when I'm having a relaxing time on my bike, I can't help but think, oh, I wonder if I could write this into an interesting story. So I think I've made a bit of a curse for myself.
Last question. When I think about the future...
Oof. When I think about the future...
open one.
Gosh, that is a very open one. When I think about the future, I hope that for me will involve me writing books and making podcasts and climbing trees and swimming in rivers and being happy with that, not thinking, I should be doing more, I should be doing more, I should be doing more. So I'm trying to learn to calm down, I think.
You mentioned your podcast, you mentioned your books. How can our listeners most easily keep up to date with your projects? And where can they find them?
You can find me if you type my name, Alistair Humphreys, into whatever it is you're interested in. I'm probably there on the internet, on all the different channels. I also have an email newsletter, which is on my website, alistairhumphreys.com. That's a good hub for everything.
Great. Okay, of course, I will link to that in the show notes. And we want to mention once more your current book, which is called My Midsummer Morning, right? It's out now.
Yeah, that's out now. It's coming out in German with a totally different title, which I can't remember. But my name won't be changing, even though the in the translation.
That's good. I will look out for it.
Thank you.
Great. Well, Alistair, thank you very, very much for this interesting and wide-ranging conversation. I enjoyed it. And I thank you for the time that you have given us to do that.
My pleasure. I've enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Bye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.